Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Art Institute, and welcome to this lecture celebrating El Greco's Assumption of the Virgin. My name is Jeff Nigro. I am Director of Adult Programs in the Department of Museum Education at the Art Institute. It's a very great pleasure to welcome you all this evening to this lecture, which celebrates the 100th anniversary of one of the most important acquisitions in the history of the Art Institute. As you'll hear later, the great painting, The Assumption of the Virgin, by Domenikos Theotokopoulos, known as El Greco, arrived at this museum in 1906. Its acquisition marked not only the arrival of an unquestioned masterpiece into the Art Institute's burgeoning collections, it also helped to put us on the map, really, as collectors of outstanding European art. As you'll hear, the story of the acquisition of the painting is fairly complicated, and so there wasn't one single date, say, that, you know, we could say 100 years ago we're going to, you know, 100 years later to the day that it walked in the Art Institute's doors or whatever we might celebrate it. It's hard to pick, so I kind of arbitrarily decided to choose a date in 2006 for the 100th anniversary that was a date closest to the celebration of the Feast of the Assumption in the Roman Catholic calendar, which was the day before yesterday. When casting about for a scholar who could present to us on El Greco and the Assumption, the story of the painting itself, as well as how it arrived here, as well as some sense that you can get of the greatness of this great painting, I frankly didn't have to cast very far. I mean, I really didn't think about it much. It was very clear to me from the beginning that the choice of scholar would be Richard Mann. Dr. Mann has been to the Art Institute many times, and his intimate knowledge of our El Greco holdings will very soon be evident to you. Most memorably for me, he came to Chicago in 2000 when he studied the Assumption and our other El Greco paintings as part of the research and lecture series sponsored by the Community Associates of the Art Institute. The fresh new information that Dr. Mann brought with him and the revelations that emerged because of his visit here were so striking that I was delighted that he agreed to speak here again this year, this evening, in celebration of this very important anniversary. Before I proceed with an introduction of our speaker, I would like to take this opportunity to make a respectful request that, out of consideration to the speaker and those around you, if you could please ensure that cell phones, pagers, and other electronic devices are switched off or silenced for the duration of the program, it would be most appreciated. Richard Mann is professor of art and art history at San Francisco State University. He received his PhD from the Institute of Fine Arts at New York University after having previously received his Master of Arts degree in art history from the University of Minnesota at Minneapolis. Richard Mann is a leading international authority on the work of El Greco. His book, El Greco and His Patrons, was originally published in 1989. The recently revised Spanish edition, El Greco y sus Patronos, was published in Madrid in 2001, and it was described by the newspaper El País as, quote, one of the most significant books ever published on a complex and tumultuous period of our Spanish national history, end quote. His work on El Greco was honored with the Delno C. West Award of the Rocky Mountain Medieval and Renaissance Association in 2001. Dr. Mann has also delved into the work of Goya, Gaudí, and other Spanish artists. His publications include Spanish paintings of the 15th through 19th centuries, a catalog for the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C. Dr. Mann currently is working on a new comprehensive catalog of El Greco's work. This catalog will include many new attributions and will explain how the artist's bold visual language synthesized Greek, Byzantine, and Western European Renaissance artistic conventions, and I'll touch on some of that this evening. Given the depth and breadth of research required to do justice to this great and prolific artist, this work, as you can imagine, has been taking some time. But there is something more immediately on the horizon. He tells me that what was going to be a single section or chapter of the introduction overview of the catalog is turning into a book all on its own about how El Greco has been interpreted throughout history not only in art historical writing and in art, but even in popular culture, such as films, not just films about El Greco, but why people in movies like El Greco and what that's supposed to say about their characters. It's quite a fascinating story. And again, it's an aspect that he'll touch on a little bit tonight with the kind of revival of interest in El Greco at just the time that the Art Institute, just about the time that the Art Institute acquired the Assumption. Dr. Mann has made many exciting discoveries about El Greco's life and art over years of close and thoughtful study, which he has published and presented in a variety of venues. His lecture this evening celebrates El Greco's Assumption, its importance to the history of art, of the artist, and of the Art Institute. Please welcome Richard Mann for his lecture, El Greco's Assumption of the Virgin, The Journey of a Masterpiece from Renaissance Toledo to Modern Chicago.
Thank you. I want to thank Jeff for that generous introduction. And I also want to thank the Museum Education Department as a whole for giving me this chance to participate in the commemoration of the purchase of this picture. To us today, we recognize this as a masterpiece. So I think it is hard for us to appreciate how bold the acquisition of this picture was. In 1906, El Greco was a very, very obscure artist. The few scholars and critics who knew about his work thought that he was a very insignificant artist who was probably crazy and did really bizarre work that should be avoided. So this acquisition showed a curatorial vision, which was really, really exciting and remarkable, and I think has characterized the Art Institute at other times. So, given all that, I'm really honored to be participating in this because it is a really exciting event. It was not like a sort of obvious acquisition at the time, though to us it seems that way. The acquisition of the Assumption by the Art Institute really helped make El Greco better known. And not only did it help make the Art Institute better known, but it did actually contribute to helping to revive interest in El Greco. Painted sometime between 1577 and 1579, the Assumption was the most important component of El Greco's first monumental commission. It helped to establish his reputation as one of the leading artists working in Spain during the 16th century. It is one of his largest pictures. It is over 400 centimeters tall, but it is not simply the size, but it's really more the bold handling of the pictorial elements that make this such an important painting. To help place the Assumption in context, I want to first look at a bit of his biography and earlier career to see how the Assumption evolved out of his life and earlier work. Now, as Jeff already indicated, the actual name of the artist is Dominicus Theotocopoulos. The nickname we use for him, El Greco, was actually invented by his Spanish friends. And it actually is an accurate reflection of the different elements that came together in his life and work. El, Spanish word for the. Greco is not a Spanish word, but an Italian word, so that emphasizes his importance of his interaction with Italy, and Greco, of course, emphasizing his Greek heritage. This I'm showing you here is what is probably his only self-portrait, done about 1595 to 1600. And just a map here to remind us of the journey, not only of the picture, but of El Greco himself, starting out in Candia, Crete, over here, spending extensive time in Venice, then Rome, and then finally settling in Toledo. Although El Greco comes to fame in Spain, he begins his artistic career in his native Crete. He receives his training in Candia, which is where he is born in 1541. And this map from the late 16th century gives us a sense of the importance of Candia. It is this city here on the northern coast. You can see how very large it is. And it was a very prosperous, and it was also the largest city, the cultural as well as the political capital of the country. At the top of this map, you can pick out the symbolic device, this lion winged lion, the Lion of St. Mark, which is a symbol of the city of Venice. And since 1211, Crete had been part of the Venetian Empire. As a prosperous trading center, shipping port, it was a very important stronghold of Venice. It was a major center of trading for the whole of the Venetian Empire. It was also a stronghold against attack by the Turks of Venice itself. And this engraving, done probably in the later 16th century, gives us this sense, at least, of Crete as a major seaport. Now, as part of the Venetian Empire, there was a lot of cultural interaction going on in Candia at this time. Beginning in the 15th century, in order to help solidify their stronghold, to encourage the Cretans to like Venice, in other words, the Venetians are encouraging interaction of the Greek population with Italian residents coming in from Venice. So by El Greco's lifetime, there is a lot of cultural interaction. There's intermarriage is very common. Most middle and upper class Cretans, although their native language would be Greek, could also fluently speak Italian. There's also a lot of religious interaction because the Roman Catholics, who made up about 20% of the population, shared church buildings with the Greek Orthodox community. Basically, all the church furnishings were made portable, and they would switch altarpieces as needed. If it's going to be a Greek Orthodox or Catholic service, just bring one or the other in. Now, this type of fluid interaction was not carried over into the visual arts in El Greco's lifetime, however. In El Greco's time in Crete, there was Italian art imported into the island, but the Greek artists working in Crete tended to work in a style of the Byzantine style, long associated with the Greek Orthodox Church, and not so much in the Italian style. So there was that separation in the arts, though not in other aspects of life. And it is in that Byzantine style that El Greco received his earliest training. By 1566, he was the head of a workshop for the production of icons for the Greek Orthodox Church. And icons have tended to be consistent through long periods of history because, according to Greek Orthodox belief, they are not simply representations in a symbolic way, but they actually embody the spiritual, so it actually becomes present in the icon. So there's a real emphasis on moving forms away from naturalism towards a sense of them being totally spiritual. And we get that adherence to that perspective in this work, which is typical of the icons that El Greco produced. This is actually done near the end of his time in Crete, done probably shortly before 1567. It is representing the Dormition of the Virgin, which is a very characteristic subject for the Greek Orthodox community. And we see here, it is the passing of the Virgin from earth to heaven. The disciples are gathered around her deathbed, as well as Christ himself, who has come down from the heavens. And he's receiving here that child he's holding actually represents the soul of the Virgin Mary, which he will then bring up to the heavens. Up above, we see the Virgin in the heavens being adored by St. Thomas, who couldn't be present here, so he had a chance to adore in the heavens. In style, too, this is adhering to Byzantine tradition, the gold background, very characteristic, flattening the space in various ways, the way the contours of the figures are strongly emphasized. They help flatten, remove the figures very much from this world. Also, a real sense of pushing the space up, you can see in the architecture. Yet, if we compare this picture to a more typical representation of the Dormition of the Virgin, a more traditional one, we can see that it maybe at first glance it looks like, well, there's a lot of similarities here. And yes, there are. But if we look at them closely, I think we can start picking out a number of differences here. Although the basic conception of the scene very much the same, if you look at the El Greco, you can see that there's much more sense of three-dimensional modeling with light and shade on the figures. There is also more individual treatment of the facial features here, much more sense that they're all the same.
hear more differences among the figures, and particularly some very naturalistic handling of light around this dove of the Holy Spirit. You will notice that there is no dove of the Holy Spirit over there. And the dove of the Holy Spirit is a specifically Catholic image. So it is interesting that around this Catholic image, we've got more naturalistic handling of light. And notice how that dove sort of seems to extend back into space. Another distinctive element here that we don't see in the painting by Ritsos is this candelabra in the foreground, which looks very Italian Renaissance in style, was probably based on an engraving. It is on this, on the bottom of this, that El Greco signs his name. And so he's identifying himself with this Italian element. But simply signing his name is very different than the Byzantine practice, because these icons are being offered as devotional acts, and so you're not calling attention to your individual, you know, act of creation. And he's doing that more in Italian practice. So he's already showing a sort of synthesis of cultural tradition. So he's creating a visual language that relates to what's going on in the world around him, but that we don't see taking place so much in the work of other visual artists in Crete. Occasionally, and this is, I just wanted to show something where you got at least a bit more Italian to suggest El Greco's not the only one moving a bit towards Italy. This is an anonymous picture done in Crete towards the end of the 16th century. And maybe with this triation here, you can see more sense of the modeling with the light handled on this figure, a little bit more sense of depth. But compared to the El Greco, it still seems very flat, and certainly we don't have anything like the candelabra or the dove of the Holy Spirit. So in comparison with his contemporaries, El Greco is already showing this interest in Italy. And so it is not surprising that in the end of 1567, he decides to move from his native country to Venice. And in Venice, he does not study with any other artists, but he decides to retool himself as an artist. And that transformation he makes is really remarkable because it is totally done on his own. It is perhaps the most remarkable incident in at least this period of a self-taught artist going on to really retool. And this picture of the purification of the temple is done probably around 1569, so about 2 years after he leaves his native Crete. Now, we get a sense of he's in many ways changed what he's doing, but we also get a sense here that he's still learning what to do. And I want to show you a number of comparative details to give you a sense of how he's borrowing from a number of different sources. And then he's not yet found a distinctive visual language to put them all together, but he will very shortly. And so this would be a bit quick because I want to get on to the assumption, but I think it's interesting to see how much he's looking at. He's really studying everything. The composition or the theme of the purification of the temple was one that was very popular in Venice in the 16th century. It was a part of a lot of cycles of the Christ's life in the decorating the walls of the guild halls for the merchants in Venice. And the a very typical example, which I think could have influenced El Greco, is the Stefano Sonnotto example, where you see very similarly the Christ twisted very dynamically and also posed before this lavish architectural vista. But perhaps even closer is the composition of the purification devised by Michelangelo. And this was never actually finished by Michelangelo in a painting himself, but it was copied by many of his followers, as here by Venusti. And if you notice that there's a very similar wave-like effect of the figures moving away, and also the dynamically twisted figure of Christ here, very similar pose. So El Greco is quoting from these major Renaissance artists, which was a way that Renaissance artists in Italy sort of showed they were current with everything, but then they try and surpass their prototypes.
Greco's also looking at Raphael, a work he probably knew in an engraving, the School of Athens. But there's a lot of similarity with this arch here in the School of Athens, this one here, and the similar idea of it being framed by the sculpture in the niches on either side. Quoting again from Raphael, a figure of a mother and child looks like it's quoted from a figure of a mother and child from this. This is a detail, and I'm sorry about the poor quality of the Raphael image, but it gives you a sense of that figure of the mother and child being quoted. Quoting a very different type of source, this Titian, nude Ariadne, in the foreground of this Bacchanal, which was a very famous picture. And this figure here from the left side is almost a reversal with the pose, the upthrust arm, but it's clothed. We still have a breast exposed there, but it's a clothed figure made a bit more demure, but a recognizable quote. And so bringing the sensual element as well. There's also a whole lot of still life detail here that's almost crowding the composition, and the works by Bassano family, who were working in Venice and did many examples of the purification of the temple, would be a prototype for that. Now, in addition to all of these details that he's borrowing, specific motifs, he's studying style. In Crete, he's working in tempera, which is egg yolk-based painting. In Venice, he's learning to paint in oil, and he is learning by studying Titian, Tintoretto, other artists who are working in a very free and bold manner in their handling of paint. And I'm just showing this as a typical example of the type of work by Titian that El Greco could have seen. It's got many variations of texture in this. He's also allowing the reddish-brown ground underneath to show through and add to the warmth. That may seem a minor detail, but it's something that El Greco is going to develop very significantly in the Assumption. When we look at close-up details of this purification, we can see that El Greco may be having some trouble getting as free and bold as Titian. The brushwork looks a bit jerky, which is understandable. He's painting in a medium he hasn't used before, and so he's learning to sort of imitate this method. It isn't yet his own, but it's going to be very quickly his own. In 1570, he moves to Rome, and his style sort of solidifies there. He builds upon what he has learned in Venice and also studying more works in Rome. And you can see in this Pietà, this is now, by the way, in the Hispanic Society in New York, that the composition has become more focused. We don't have a lot of extraneous detail. Emotionally and also compositionally, we focus on the essential. The handling of the paint is much more fluid. The colors are really glowing. The compositions, again, using earlier artists here, Michelangelo, we can see how he has copied this Pietà composition by Michelangelo in the handling of the body of Christ. He has gotten, El Greco has gotten, the sense of the monumentality, the power of El Greco. Of Michelangelo. But he has done this. I'm warm. I'm going to take this off. Excuse me. He has gotten the power, the monumentality, the sense of the size of Michelangelo. But this is a tiny picture. It is only about 5.5 inches tall, but it seems much bigger. And El Greco is extremely frustrated in Italy because he wants to work on a big scale, and he annoys people a lot because he goes around and is always saying that he could be the greatest artist ever known if he got a chance to paint on a big scale, and it doesn't work. He's admitted to the Academy of St. Luke, which is the Painters Guild in Rome, 1572, but as a miniature painter. Frustrated, he decides to go to Spain because he thinks he might have a better chance of getting work there. So at the end of 1577, he moves again. He spends a few weeks in the summer in Barcelona on the coast up here. Then he moves to the center of the country, to Madrid, where he's hoping to find work in Madrid because Philip II, the king, is undertaking a lot of building projects. But again, no. So he was undoubtedly very happy to to get a job working in Toledo, which is just south of Madrid. Toledo had been the effective capital of Spain until 1561, when Philip II moves the capital to Madrid. So this is a major loss of prestige for the city. But Toledo still has a sense of prestige because it is the head of all of the other Catholic churches within the country. It is called the Primacy of Spain. Ecclesiastical church matters are taken very seriously there. One out of every 10 adults is either a nun or a monk or a priest. So you get a sense of how important church affairs were. So it's not surprising that it's got a very religious mood, and I think maybe El Greco was trying to capture that in the view he did of what became his new city, Toledo, in a picture he did much later in his career. I've dated here 1610, but it might actually be closer to 1600. In any case, he's greatly changed the look of the city. He's moved the cathedral complex to the top of what has now become an enormous cliff to suggest the importance of the church to the city. He's also shown it in the midst of a dramatic storm, which may be indicating the sort of spiritual strength of the city surviving the problems of what was at the time perceived of as a sort of Protestant assault upon Catholicism. El Greco's first commission that brings him to Toledo is from one of the leaders of the Catholic Church in Toledo, Don Diego de Castilla. Don Diego had been appointed dean of Toledo Cathedral, the second highest office of the cathedral, in 1551. But his official, or his unofficial, I should say, power was much higher. Because between 1559 to 1577, Castillo was the effective head of the cathedral because the archbishop, Archbishop Carranza, was imprisoned by the Inquisition. He was charged with being a Protestant heretic, and he was supposed to be a Protestant heretic because he recommended that the Catholic Church sell off its church buildings and use that money to pay for charitable activities for the poor. Now, before the Inquisition, Don Diego defended Carranza, but he was determined to not, you know, have the same fate, say, befall him, perhaps because he did a very large amount of building of various sorts and decorating of church buildings. And Don Diego gave El Greco a role in his most important undertaking, which was the reconstruction, the entire rebuilding of a very important church convent, the convent church of Santo Domingo el Antiguo, which was a convent of Cistercian nuns. And under Don Diego's patronage, the medieval church going back to the 12th century was torn down. It was rebuilt in the style of the latest style, very austere style, by the leading architect of Toledo, Nicolas de Vergara. El Greco gets an important role in this. He is commissioned to do all of the altarpieces, which include 9 large paintings. He designs the architectural frames, his 2 side altars, as well as the main altar, which is where the Assumption was located. The colors in this are a bit off, so I'm going to go forward to the main altar because it's a more appealing view that gives you a sense of what it all looked like. Don Diego got the right, or claimed the right, to reconstruct this church, which was a very prestigious undertaking, because he was the executor of the estate of a wealthy widow, Doña Maria da Silva, who had lived in the convent since 1538. On her death in 1575, she left all of her money to the convent. She did not say how the money was to be built, but he said the only way of creating a tribute to her memory was to rebuild this entire church. Now, Don Diego's reasons for doing this were not as disinterested as he claimed. Doña Maria da Silva was actually his mistress. He had gotten to know her
as her confessor, and they quickly developed a closer relationship. And in 1540, their son, Don Luis, was born. And it was actually Don Diego's son, who he always called his much younger brother. Don Luis was born, and it was Don Luis who knew El Greco, because Don Luis was studying in Rome at the same time El Greco was there, and they had a lot of common acquaintances. And Don Luis made the original contract for the pictures with El Greco. But his father quickly took over the management of this whole project and was very pleased with what El Greco was doing. Now, as a result of the patronage of the church, Don Diego got the right to use this area as a burial chapel. So Don Diego and Don Luis are buried over on this side. In fact, you see one of their markers here. And then Doña Maria da Silva is buried on the other side. So this is effectively a personal family chapel. It was not acknowledged as such publicly, but that's what it was. And all of these pieces have a function appropriate to a funerary chapel, which, you know, helps ensure the salvation of the individuals buried in that place. In the 19th century, the paintings, most of the paintings of the main altar, were sold by the convent to raise money. But they replaced them with copies, as we see here, so we can get a sense of how this ensemble worked. And the paintings stood out very strongly against these plain whitewashed walls. You can see that the Assumption is by far the largest of the elements here. It is by far the tallest. On either side, there's St. John the Evangelist, St. John the Baptist. They are full-length pictures, which I'll be showing you. Then there's half-length pictures of two Cistercian order saints, Bernard and Benedict. And then at the top is the Trinity, which we'll also be looking at, as well as the Veil of Veronica. Now, for two of the pictures, the two St. Johns, we have preparatory drawings preserved. This is the final picture in the altarpiece, or for the main altar area, and then the two drawings which El Greco made. This drawing, which I've placed on the far side, was probably the first drawing he made. It's much more different. It is conceived as though it was in a sculptural niche. It's got a more twisted pose. In this, he's moved towards that frontal pose, and we get this also squared, so we get a sense of it being prepared for transfer, like he's using it as a geometric model to transfer to a bigger level picture. The one thing that is not included is that eagle over there. For the St. John the Baptist on the other side, we have only one drawing, and it is already very much like the pose of the final figure, although, again, it is conceived in the Venetian manner as though it were a sculpture in a niche. And he got rid of that effect in the end and decided to put them more against a sort of flat sky treatment. Now, there are no other drawings preserved for Santo Domingo. It is possible that these have all been lost. We don't know. But it also seems possible that as El Greco's confidence grew, he felt it was no longer necessary to make these preparatory drawings. And we do not have drawings from the later part of El Greco's career because he didn't typically use them later. I think at the beginning of this major project, it was the first time he worked on a big scale, he felt the need for this assistance, and then not later. So I'm assuming the two St. Johns are first. I don't know that for sure, but it seems possible. The Trinity, which we see here, is located immediately above the Assumption, and it also has to do with this funerary purpose, because we get here the body of Christ being raised up to heaven, accepted as sacrifice, atonement of the sins of the human race. In the conception of this theme, El Greco probably looked at this print by Albrecht Dürer, which he owned. Since he did own the print, it seems a likely source with the bodies of the angels surrounding the heavenly group. But in the conception of the figure of Christ, and the way the angels are arranged on the side, he may also be recalling this earlier Trinity. And we can see how his handling has become much more monumental, the colors much more glowing. So he's really, I think, mastering the principles of style even more. Intermediary between the Trinity and the Assumption is this holy face of Veronica's veil, again connected to the theme of salvation because it has to do with the passion of Christ, the face of Christ being imprinted on the cloth as Veronica wipes Christ's face off. It is possible, it seems quite likely, that this sculptural group with the shield and the two putti were actually executed by Abruzzo himself, unlike any of the other sculpture. We don't know that for sure, but it's much more similar to the style of his painting. Now, finally, the Assumption. You get all the other things around there, and you can see, though, that this is the biggest, the most splendid picture, and that has to do with this funerary function I keep mentioning, because this was very important to salvation. It is only the Virgin Mary coming up to heaven that enabled her to act as an intercessor for the faithful to ensure their salvation. Also, Mary is, of course, the name saint of Doña Maria da Silva, and we have very prominently in the foreground the name saint of Don Diego. Diego is the Spanish equivalent of James, and we have St. James the Greater here pleading up to Mary as if to assist in salvation. The book before St. James is a standard attribute of James in Spain. Don Diego and the other early viewers of this picture must have been really impressed with it. It is so much more advanced in terms of understanding Italian Renaissance conventions, and they were sort of dominating all of Europe at the time, is much more advanced than any other artist working in the city. Correa del Vivar, who I'm showing you here, was the leading artist before El Greco got there. But his Death of the Virgin, at least a similar subject here, shows some attempt to get the Italian style. We get, you know, an attempt to get curvilinear poses, but it is much flatter. The bodies are much more awkward. The colors are flat. They don't have those glowing qualities of El Greco's picture. Excuse me. There were many Italian sources that El Greco probably looked at in this, but the one he most likely studied most closely is Titian's Assumption of the Virgin, which established the modern imagery for this theme. Titian was the first artist to show the Virgin ascending to heaven on her own rather than being lifted up. This painting of the Assumption also helped to establish Titian's reputation in Venice, so it plays a very similar role in Titian's career as the Assumption that we have in Chicago plays in El Greco's. Now, in looking at them, you may immediately pick out the similarities, but we'll see that there are actually a number of differences. For one thing, El Greco has eliminated God the Father so that we focus even more on the figure of Mary. He has retained that spiral pose, the outstretched arms. He has, made a couple of significant changes. He has underneath her feet the half moon, the crescent moon, which represents the Immaculate Conception, which was a belief very popular in Spain but had not been accepted by Catholics in other parts of Europe yet. Also, her figure in the El Greco painting, you can see that her figure sort of sways outwards. And when it was displayed in its original context, she would have seemed to be protecting the sacraments on the altar, so visualizing her role as a protector of the church. Also similar on the lower level, very dramatic poses for the apostles. However, you can note that in the Greco, they're more closely compressed together, and they also have more contemplative expressions. They're less outwardly dramatic. For the figure of St. James, I think that El Greco looked to a very significant borrowing from Michelangelo in The Last Judgment. Now, I'm showing you just the top section of that very huge fresco, and I specifically want to focus on this figure of St. Bartholomew over here. And I just showed that detail so you'll see where it is. But if you compare these, you could see that the pose is even with up to the hand poses, are all very similar. Now, when he was in Rome, El Greco constantly bragged not only that he could execute the greatest work ever done, but that he could have done the Last Judgment better than Michelangelo, which really, you know, really annoyed people. And I think this quotation or revision from Michelangelo is, you know, his way of saying, yeah, I can do it. Because we have that sense of the power, the muscularity of the figure. But in place of this flayed skin, which Bartholomew is holding up, and this with what was thought to be a self-portrait of the artist, this being a sort of intervention on behalf of Michelangelo himself, we have El Greco putting this book, which is symbolic, but instead of this face, self-portrait on the flayed skin, we have there this paper. And on this paper, we have the signature for El Greco. And this is a very unique signature in his work because it says Dominicus Teotocopoulos displayed this in 1577. Now, that word displayed is very bold to use in Greek. This is in Greek. And so it really has a sense of, wow, that his other signatures don't have. I should note that the date, 1577, is probably not the date he finished this because he just starts this in August, this whole group. He probably does the two St. Johns first, but he's probably putting that earlier date to give himself that little extra boost of pride. Sorry. I'm not used to having this microphone there, so I apologize for that. Boom. I'll be done with these quotations soon. I realize they get very sort of heavy-handed, but they are very important the way Renaissance artists thought. In addition to quoting from other famous artists, or already famous artists, I should say, in El Greco's case, El Greco also quoted from himself, which along with the signature, I think is a way of showing pride. And just as one example of the several borrowings, the figure of St. John the Evangelist, with figure seen from the back, I think quoted from his earlier composition of Christ healing the blind man. And that's just a detail of that earlier painting. Greco is the only one who would have recognized these borrowings, but I think that he was, in a sense, concerned with proving to himself that he had achieved the status. Now, in many ways, I think he had achieved the status in doing this. And every time I look at this picture, I get this sense. And in the summer of 2000, I did have the chance to look really close up at this picture with a team of conservators from here. And we had the chance to look very close up at this picture. It was moved from the frame that it was in at that time, which was much heavier, much further off the floor than it is now. But it was moved out of that frame, as you can see, and a hydraulic lift was brought in. And so we got to move up and down and really look close up. And that really was so exciting, a little dangerous at times, but exciting, because we really got to see just how bold his handling of paint was. And I want to show you a few details so you get a sense of that. This is a detail of the hand of St. James, and I wanted to show it partly because you've got a lot of the preparatory ground exposed here. You can see the canvas weave, so the texture and the ground, which was normally covered by artists, contributes to the effect. So the painting means becoming very important here. And also, he's sort of contoured out the hand with very strong, thick paint, making it almost like a sculptural effect to really emphasize it. That sculptural effect of bringing this forward, we can also see in this head of the bald disciple, also on that right side, and all of my references right and left are from your point of view looking at the picture right here. And you can see that he's got these very strong contouring lines there. El Greco, we know from his notes, actually works very slowly, methodically. But he creates the effect that he's doing this very quickly, as if to sort of show off, I can just do this, you know, I'm that good. And he creates that effect of working quickly by the way you can see up there, there's like this drip of paint down from the blue sky, as if he was very careless there. But I think that was probably very carefully planned out. This is a close-up of the draperies around St. Peter, and you can see
the very bold color interaction here, the yellows, the oranges, the greens. But I particularly wanted you to see the very bold handling of paint. He's left fingerprints in various places, as well as marks of the thick bristles of his brush. He's built up the fingers very thickly and used his own handprints and the stick end of his brush to shape those fingers. So really manipulating the paint in this very vivid way. We can also see that in this figure of St. John the Evangelist, where you get very vividly in this detail that sense of the texture of some of the fingerprints and also the brush prints. In the upper section, he was very concerned, I think, with making sure that the figure of the Virgin was prominent from below. And he's given her figure a real sense of thickness, because she is, even in when we have it in the gallery now, it's much lower. It's hard to see that upper section still. It is a huge painting. And that figure is, you know, very thickly painted and with very, very heavy texturing of the brushwork, which you can get some sense of that real textured effect in the hand, which really sort of gives physical substance to her spiritual being. So El Greco is using his artistic form to express through the form, the spiritual power of the being. And that's almost modernist, I think, in the way he's using the power of the form itself, the media, to express the spiritual concept. In the other parts of the upper section, some of the paint's also thick, but it's much more fluid and flowing in the angels. And I just wanted to show this passage because it was so beautiful, but also because I thought that this interaction of the colors, the pinks, the blues, the yellows, helps us to see why El Greco was so esteemed by some of the later Impressionist artists. And note the way he's got the effect of light on the arm extending back into space. This is that same angel, but the drapery here is much more thinly painted in this section, as if the being is dematerializing. In the cherub's head beneath, just to the lower section of the Virgin, we really get a sense of how he has brought in the glazing, the translucent paints, but he's painted them with the thickness that is normally associated with heavy impasto-type paints. And again, we have a strong contour helping to set off this figure. I wanted to show this detail of the angel, because this is one of the only sections where El Greco made a change. I mean, he's painting this big picture, just going for it. And he makes one sort of very small change in the feet here. And it looks like the feet, you can see that line there, that it would have extended more out towards the viewer. And maybe he thought that would somehow detract from the Virgin, so he pushed it back to not create that effect in the final figure. But throughout the rest of this, it is really hard, even in X-rays, to find any change. Again, moving a bit higher up in that angel, again, that combination of the translucent, the glazing, which are the glowing parts, with the heavier opaque paints, really both treated with the sense of heavy texture normally reserved for impasto. That may seem insignificant, but I think it shows El Greco's boldness in handling the painting medium. And we get in this angel, this final detail here, the sense of the thinness of the paint notable. And it's as if this angel's dissolving in space, so that spirituality coming through in the handling of the form. Now, in this boldness in handling paint, El Greco is at least equaling, and I think actually exceeding, what Titian was doing at this point. So he's showing that he's really mastered what was going on in Italy in the painting style, and certainly also in the drama, expressiveness, the handling of the anatomy as well. All the time he was in Italy, El Greco seems to have been distancing himself from the Byzantine, as if he wanted to prove he could be more Italian than the Italians. You know, he was going to succeed by becoming an Italian artist. Finally, in this picture, he seems to have come back to his Byzantine heritage, and he creates here a very unique style. It's certainly very Italian Renaissance, but I think he's also bringing in elements from his Byzantine heritage, maybe finally because he's got the confidence to go back to his roots and bring them in too.
And in comparison with what he was doing in Italy, this is much flatter. He's, again, giving us some of that sense of the flatness we have in the Byzantine icons. He is also compressing the figures together, as he did in that earlier Dormition. The colors, the areas of colors, are a bit flatter than they were in his earlier Italian or the earlier works done at Santo Domingo. And if we look at this close-up detail of the two pictures, I think you can see how he's used some similar devices with the heavy contouring around the figures and the real sort of compression of space so that figures from the back seem to be coming forward, creating that spiritual realm and mixing it with the physical. Through this synthesis of divergent cultural traditions, El Greco created a picture that could be appreciated from many different points of view. So in later centuries, it could be appreciated by people who admired the Renaissance and liked the old masters, the traditional sense of the Italian Renaissance as sort of the embodiment of that. But it could also be appreciated by avant-garde modernists who would see other things there. In the later 17th century, in 18th century, 19th century, El Greco's reputation plummets dramatically. He becomes very obscure. As I mentioned, by the time this is purchased by the Art Institute, he is a very obscure artist. But one picture that does not get into that level of disrepute for a long time is the Assumption, because people could look at it and see, well, it is sort of Venetian, and they'd say, okay, that's okay. And yeah, that's the way they were looking at it. So in 1833, it is purchased for the private collection of the Infante Don Sebastian Gabriel de Bourbon. And he bought it in 1833 from the convent, and he was trying to assemble a collection of all of the arts of Spain. And so that's why he wanted, you know, an important example by El Greco. In 1835, so that means only 2 years after he bought it, the Spanish government takes it from him because he had participated in a coup d'etat, unsuccessfully, obviously, since he didn't get to keep his pictures. So between 1835 and 1861, this picture is displayed at the new National Museum of Pictures in Madrid. In 1861, the painting is returned to the Infante for his private collection. And he brought it with him to France in 1868. In 1868, he is exiled permanently from Spain because he again participated in a coup d'etat. While the picture is in France, it is seen by Charles Blanc, who is a leading French art critic of the time. He writes about the Assumption in Gazette des Beaux-Arts, and he praised it as the most important work of El Greco, and he emphasized that it was at least as good as works by Venetian artists. After the Infante's death in 1875, his widow, Doña Isabel, brings it back to Spain, and she proudly displays it in her palace outside Madrid. In 1902, at her death, her heirs are eager to get rid of it. By this time, El Greco's reputation has fallen so low that even the special sort of concessions given to the Assumption are not enough to make this seem a desirable picture. The heirs are unable to sell the picture when it is offered at auction in Madrid in 1902. To try and create interest in it, they loan it to the Prado between 1902 and 1904. Several Spanish art critics try to encourage the Prado to buy it, but the curators and the directors of the Prado display no interest in acquiring it. They really don't want it, and they are clear about that point. But while the picture is displayed at the Prado, it does attract the interest of two American collectors, Louisine and Henry Havemeyer, who had already begun assembling one of the most important American collections of European old masters and modernist paintings. In 1901, in one of their trips to Madrid, they had already purchased the portrait of a cardinal for their private collection. They bought it from a private collector in Madrid. Now, Henry Havemeyer was convinced that the Assumption deserved a prominent place in an internationally important collection. The Havemeyers realized that the assumption was too big, even for their large mansion in New York. But they wanted to be involved in the future of the picture. So Havemeyer loaned the full purchase price to get the picture from the heirs to the Paris art dealer, Durand Ruel. So Durand Ruel, with Havemeyer's money, buys the picture from the heirs of the Infanta. In 1904, he gets it for the equivalent of $17,000. In exchange for this, Havemeyer gets the title to the picture, so he can retain ownership for it if he wants. Havemeyer is already a trustee and patron of the Metropolitan Museum of New York, and he is convinced the Metropolitan is the appropriate place for this picture. So in 1904, Havemeyer offers the picture to the Metropolitan Museum for the original purchase price, $17,000, and he will pay the shipping. So no profit, free shipping. And the trustees are emphatic they don't want it. They write a memorandum to him that this is a bad painting by an obscure artist, you know, go away, basically. Havemeyer is very discouraged by this, so he gives up his ownership of the painting to Durand Ruel. So Durand Ruel displays the picture in his Paris gallery for the next 2 years. And in his Paris gallery, it attracts the interest of a number of avant-garde artists, including Pablo Picasso. And I think that Pablo Picasso drew upon his study of the Assumption as he evolved the Demoiselle d'Avignon. And a very different theme, admittedly, a brothel scene. But, you know, however bizarre this borrowing may seem, as a fervent anti-Catholic, Picasso might have enjoyed the sort of play off the earlier image. But I think Picasso could have found in El Greco a prototype for his desire to combine heavy three-dimensionality, monumentality, with a sense of the awareness of the picture plane. And this, this figure here, the posing of that in the foreground may be a recollection, and that perhaps even greater recollection is the way he has treated this collection of the still life as a sort of series of flat planes, like the tomb, combined with the crescent moon, which we get up above as a sort of almost direct quotation or revision of the El Greco. Now, other avant-garde artists also became interested in this picture. Mary Cassatt, among them, expatriate American artist. She had actually already been interested in El Greco through her friend Edgar Degas, who had purchased this Saint Ildefonso in 1894. So Degas was a very early advocate of El Greco, and Degas actually hung this picture over his bed because he said he wanted to wake up every morning and see such a great painting. And Cassatt felt just as strongly about the Assumption. And even though Havemeyer had been turned down by the Metropolitan, she was determined that an American museum get the Assumption. So she started contacting different museums. She first appealed to the Philadelphia Academy because she had studied there herself. And then she appealed to the Boston Museum of Fine Arts. Finally, she writes to Charles Hutchinson, who is the director of the Board of Trustees of the Art Institute. And let me get my notes. I haven't been reading these. But she wrote, "I think you cannot fail to be struck with the Greco. It is a great museum picture. I doubt if another such is for sale in Europe. It is in perfect condition and untouched." Now, by this time, Hutchinson had heard about everything that had been going on with the picture, so he decided to go over to Paris himself to see, you know, was it worth getting? And he immediately really was struck with the Greco, as Cassatt had said he would be. So he becomes determined that the Art Institute buy the picture. So he comes back very enthused, and the Board of Trustees are very, very uninterested. So after several months, he makes a deal with Durand Ruel. He gets Durand Ruel to ship the picture over on approval to see if the Art Institute might want to buy it. And he gets the right for them to display it for 60 days before deciding to purchase. This is a very unusual arrangement. It suggests how eager Durand Ruel was to be rid of the picture. But Hutchinson is enthused. It finally arrives here. It does, by mistake, go first to New York, but it gets here in the end. So it has a definite long voyage around here. After it's been displayed for 60 days, the Art Institute trustees have still not decided whether to buy it. Hutchinson keeps having votes. They keep turning it down. And so by this time, Durand Ruel is fed up. So he wants his picture back if they're not going to buy it. So Hutchinson manages. He's a great wheel dealer. He gets more time. Durand Ruel agrees, okay, you can keep it, but you have to cover it with the drapery. And so that's what was done. While the trustees hesitated, Harriet Moore, who's a critic for the Chicago Tribune, strongly advocated its acquisition in the paper. She wrote, "The intense human vitality of the picture is remarkable. The men standing astonished around the empty tomb are magnificently alive to the tips of their marvelously painted fingers. Greco was one of the bold and assured technicians of all art. He had also a profound imagination. Chicago cannot afford to lose this picture." Finally, on July 17, 1906, a couple of the most strong opponents were away on vacation. It's true. The trustees endorsed the acquisition, and they agreed to borrow all the money to pay for this. It ended up costing, with the interest charges, $38,000, twice what the Met could have gotten for, but still, it's a pretty bargain basement price. The assumption quickly became a widely recognized symbol of the progressive vitality and cultural richness of Chicago. It's written about in international magazines in those ways. And yet, even though it becomes part of the establishment, so to speak, it can still inspire the avant-garde imagination. As a child, Ernest Hemingway was frequently brought by his mother to the Art Institute, specifically to see the picture. Later in his life, in several interviews, he claimed that the opportunity to see the Assumption so often as a child had freed his imagination, and it ultimately was inspired him to write as freely as El Greco had painted. Since 1906, the Assumption has been displayed in always prominently, but in different frames. But despite the shifts in the manner of display, it has always remained one of the most popular works in the entire collection. And I think that is because even in an era when some of the old master paintings may seem irrelevant, El Greco's ability to bring together here very divergent cultural perspectives makes this picture resonate and makes it very relevant still in our multicultural society. Thank you. Sure, it's time. I don't know what time it is. I lost sense of time. I may have talked too long. I was trying to time it, but I couldn't see my watch. So I cut out a bunch of stuff, and I went way too long. I'm sorry. Because I kept trying to cut out stuff. And I guess not enough.